TheDriveScene.com.
Okay, friends, good evening. We are starting our fourth session out of five. Today's topic is dedicated to the idea of pluralism and diversity in the evolution of Judaism. And it will serve us right to start our topic by revisiting what I told you on our first session, if you remember, when we made a distinction, which I told you is going to follow us as we progress, between philosophy, theology, and religion. Do you remember that distinction? Is there anyone who would be willing to repeat it in their own two words? Do not be afraid. Nothing to, no exam at the end. It gives you a chance to be live on YouTube through iScene. I mean, go for it.
Did you say you wanted us to describe what is theology, religion, and philosophy, theology, and religion?
Yeah, the distinction that we made.
So the distinction that you made in a nutshell.
Yes, in a nutshell.
That philosophy concerns itself with the essence, with the existence of God, the Havaya of God.
Right, with the essential attributes.
True. The theology concerns itself with the purpose of creation, so the ethical dimension. So it answers the question of why. So philosophy asks the question what, and theology asks the question why, and religion asks the question how. So religion tries to merge or respond, give a practical response to the theological tenets and the philosophical.
Fantastic. Beautifully put. Beautifully put. I did something right. That now I know that I did something I did right.
I repeat your...
No, I haven't actually. I only raised this.
Very, very good summary. Very articulate. Good. So what we said, basically, is we said that based on a philosophical assumption that is whose subsoil is some essential attributes of divinity, we now postulate the creation of the world as based on a certain ethical backbone, and then we come to ask ourselves, how do we respond to that ethical backbone by reconfigurating our entire way of life? You remember we tell religion is a man-made process which basically aims to reshift our modalities of daily living in a way that most adequately responds to that what we perceive as an ethical charge, which is theology. So you put it very well. And if you remember, I told you also that if you read the Torah right from the get-go, based on this distinction, it's very easy to recognize the Torah as a theological document rather than a philosophical one, right? It starts right from the get-go with a theological assumption that the world was created for a reason and that the human, that mankind is now charged with something, and that something is usually ethical. Now we come to another point, which brings us closer to the subject matter. And that is the devastatingly ignorant assumption that some modern Jews have that there is a way to encapsulate the Jewish religion. Now I'm talking about the religious aspect of Jewish life. And that there is a right path of what you're supposed to do and what you're not supposed to do. And by the way, the word orthodox means the right path. Right? Okay. In case you didn't know. And I'm here, and I may be putting my life on a limb because now I'm being broadcasted all over the place with this. I'm here to tell you, and I mentioned that before already, that there hasn't been a moment in Jewish life where there was a consensus about the trajectory of Judaism. Anybody who tells you otherwise, and you are welcome to quote me on that, is either a liar or tries to sell you something. The second point I made was that if you actually follow the evolution of Jewish intellectual history, you find that more important than articulating the right answers was the ability to articulate the questions intelligibly each generation anew. In other words, to create a platform or a subsoil wherein each generation perceives the existential questions, the halachic questions that bother or concern Judaism, relevant. The problem we have today is no different than the problem we had 100 years ago, 200 years ago, and 1,000 years ago. Rabbis were not angry at other Jews who disagreed with them. They were petrified by those Jews who decided to remain silent. The greatest problem we have to the evolution of Jewish life is not disagreement, but indifference. That's the real threat. Those who don't care. Remember, those who argue with you still care. That's a great virtue not to be taken lightly. However, there are those within every system who would like to present their religion or their religious interpretation in a very dogmatic fashion. They will try to tell you that their religion is the one that most adequately correspond or reflect the mind of God. There will be those who will tell you that their way of doing things are in fact what God wants you to do. Now, my friends, I'm taking you back to what we talked about last week when I showed you the difference between absolute truth and applicable truth. And if you remember that incredible passage that says, Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim. These and these are the words of the living God. There is no absolute truth when it comes to halacha, but rather applicable truth. Applicable truth deals with religion. And religion, and this is where I want us to go, religion by definition is a limited manifestation of a limited mind. When we talk about the human response to the mind of God, we're talking about a response which is inherently inadequate. This is why there are so many religious figures who would love to know what God wants, because it will put them out of their human misery of living perpetually in the dark. I'll give you an example. Yadid Nefesh. Are you familiar with that homily? The Yadid Nefesh was written by Azkari in the 16th century, a friend and a colleague of Rabbi Shlomo Elkabetz, who wrote Lecha Dodi. Same time, same city. Yedid nefesh avarachaman. Have you heard it before? It's a beautiful one, right? Beautiful. Have you listened to the words? Yedid nefesh avarachaman meshoch avdecha el retzoncha. I'll translate loosely. Beloved of the soul, O merciful Father, draw thy servant to your will, or to thy will. In modern language, beam me up, Scotty. Basically, what Azkari asks here is the question or the request of a religious figure to have some sort of theological transparency. Tell me what you want. Draw me closer to your light so I may come back and serve you better. Which, by the way, is the very quintessential notion of Jewish mysticism or any mystical experience. Go up, figure it out, come down, teach others. That's the idea. Mystics don't want to go there and stay there. They want to go there in order to come back and turn this world into a better place. Or the way I like to say, to turn the world in which we live into a world in which we believe. Right? This notion of exacting the divine mind. However, this notion of exacting the divine mind is informed by the perpetual, unchanging, inherent difference between the human mind and the divine mind. The divine mind, at least we assume, is perfect. The human mind, we know, is imperfect. And if there is something that is inherently imperfect, it can never reach the level of perfection that it aspires for. I want you to understand what I just said. There is a no entry zone. There is a disparity which is existential in the human condition in that regard when we talk about the difference between religion and theology. Religion aspires to come as close as possible to the theological charge, all along knowing that this quest is never ending. Now, that paradoxical situation is the very lifeline of the relevance of Torah and religious life. Because if you could assume that you could get it one day, trust me, my friends, there would be a rabbi who would tell you, I got it already. We don't need to pursue further. Even in the world where we know that the human mind is incapable, there are those who come and tell us, we got it already. Now you just remain stupid and let us inform you. It's definitely an agenda. Question is, would you allow it? Would you allow it? Huh? Absolutely. We live in a world where people, especially after 9/11, we live in a world where there's people who will take religious precept and try to sell them as theological truth. It happens every day. Israel is no exception. It happens in all religious systems. Judaism is no exception. And just like we did in the last three times, I want to put some order in this chaos, just so we can think about it intelligibly. So let us now start with the theological level and understand why is pluralism and diversity such an important element in Jewish life from antiquity. And not like so many of us think that pluralism and diversity are the product of modernity, of the post-emancipation world, which is a myth. I'll show you. So let us start with our sources. And let us look at Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4. Which it's not... Ah, Silcha. Do we have more? Is there more sources there? Yeah. And what I asked you when I said Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4, is a verse that you all know. It's known as the Shema. It's just not cited here. It says, Hear, O Israel, God is our Lord, God is one. Or in Hebrew, Shema Israel, Hashem Eloheinu, Hashem Echad. From a theological and philosophical standpoint, the unity of the divine, the fact that God is one, at least to the human mind, makes it very difficult for us to understand that one God can have multiple voices. It brings us to believe, essentially believe, that the will of God, or that the intent of God, is as unified as the existence of God. I want you to understand what I just said. It's very, very important. If there is one God, there is one thing that God wants, or at least that the thing that God wants is manifest in one way. God wants peace. God wants you to be righteous. God wants you to be good. God wants you to treat your neighbor nicely. God wants this, God wants this, God wants that. In other words, the will of God is as unified as God himself, which is, by the way, a major theological assumption, even a philosophical one in major systems. In other words, we assume that the unity of God gives an absolute unity to the divine will. And by the way, the Torah is written in many ways in such a way. So are the early Mishnaic and Talmudic literature. Let's look. Let's go to the source at the bottom, then we'll go to the source at from Deuteronomy, then we'll go to Babylonian Talmud. If a case is too baffling for you to decide on each matter of dispute, you shall promptly repair to the place. This is what God is telling Moses to tell the Israelites. Repair to the place that the Lord your God will have chosen and appear before the Levite priests or the magistrate in charge at the time and present your problem. When they have announced to you the verdict in the case, you shall carry out that verdict, observing scrupulously all their instruction to you. You must not deviate from the verdict that they announced to you, either to the right or to the left. What do we hear here? What are the assumptions that are packed inside this verse or this paragraph from Deuteronomy? Problems appear in life that need halachic ruling, as we call it in the rabbinic period. What happens? What is the process?
There's a mechanism of
mediation through. Now go resort. go back to what we talked about last week, my friends. It all ties together. The Axis Mundi, right? The ones who are now negotiating the relation between the mind of God and right? And what do those priests do? And what do they do then? And what kind of an answer is that? How are you supposed to treat that answer? It's an orthodox answer. I mean orthodox in the classical sense of the word. It's this is what you should do. You should deviate neither to the left nor to the right. Do exactly as you're told. There is an assumption here embedded in the text that there is a right way and that that right way, that right path can become tangible and visible to humans through the Axis Mundi. And then you should carry it forward. In other words, there is an assumption that there is a possibility of a straight line from the theological charge to the religious response.
I think that maybe there is a point that we have to differentiate between orthodoxy and orthopraxy. So here, what it is trying to suggest is that the orthopraxy, there is an orthopraxy, not necessarily an orthodoxy.
Can you explain what you mean so everybody shares in the... Fantastic.
Ultimately, somebody, you know, you have to know how you're going to eat. So I'm going to show you. So I can't figure out how God told me that I should eat. So I defer it to the Levites or whoever it is, the authority, the mediator. And they have to decide ultimately how I'm going to eat. And whatever they decide, you shall do. And that has to be a consensus for everybody. But it's not necessarily a reflection of the orthodoxy. It's just that we have to know we have to eat. So somebody has.
Great. So you're saying on the religious realm, on the most tangible realm, there must be some sort of an agreement.
And that's the orthodoxy, and that's where the unity comes. That's a reflection of the oneness, but it's not really orthodoxy.
Great. Now, is that reflection true with a capital T?
It's not true, like God's truth.
Yeah. Ah, so we'll see what kind of a filter truth is it and what are the impacts of that kind of truth, let's call it the truth with a lowercase t, on the view of pluralism and diversity in a minute. Let's now look at the Babylonian Talmud. This is the second source we have at the first page. Rabbi Chanina said, you see it? Who would like to read for us? Close to landing here, yeah? Okay, a man's steps are decided by the Lord.
What does the man know about his own way?
Okay. What do we hear here from Rabbi Chanina? What is Chanina telling us about the relationship between humans, the human realm, and the divine realm? There's one word that encapsulates the whole thing.
Determinism.
Exactly. Determinism. This is classical determinism. You don't lift a finger in this world unless it was already decreed so, right? So decreed by the heavens. What are the implications of this kind of classical determinism? A determination that was, by the way, brought about one of the greatest philosophical questions in Jewish thought. Hakol tzafui v'harashut netuna. It negates free will. If it negates free will, what else does it negate? Precisely. Okay, now you got one. And I want everybody here to understand what we just said. If it negates free will, in other words, if we're talking about a divinity that knows everything you are set to do, in other words, we believe in a completely predetermined destiny, and you have no free will, it means that you cannot be held accountable for whatever it is you did because you had no choice of changing it, which, by the way, is definitely not the view of classical Judaism. I just want to make sure here. And the same Rabbi Chanina somewhere else says, Akol beidei shamayim milvad yirat shamayim. Everything is in the hands of heaven except one major thing, the human acceptance of the authority of heaven. Which is a brilliant, brilliant maneuver out of this challenging determinism. But based on this, we seem to have a very interesting view that comes and says, a man is, as it were, imprisoned in the absolute mind of God. The divine knowledge is a knowledge that already predetermines human conduct. And if it predetermines human conduct, how should you be held accountable for whatever you did in this world? By the way, it brings profound ethical questions. I don't even want to take you about this theory with Nazism and fascism and the Holocaust and how do you treat Hitler if he had no choice, all kinds of things, which I don't want to go into right now. What I do want to go into right now is that perception that the divine mind is all-encompassing but also an animating mind. It is a mind that controls human behavior. This thing is obviously to change. Now I'm taking you back to our last session when we talked about the gradual but very important paradigm shift from divine authorship to human authority. We're not going to go back there. We discussed it for 2 hours. But now we have to take into question the first part of the Shema. The second part of the Shema said, God is one. What does the first part of the Shema say? Hear, O. And what is Israel? Or who is Israel? A nation made of? Tribes made of? Don't be shy, it's people. Individuals. Israel is not a unified community. Israel, by definition, is already, right, an entity made of multiple individuals. And if you think for a second that that notion was overlooked or bypassed in early Judaism, you are very, very wrong. I'm going to start it with something by Rabbi Yosef Soloveitchik, who is a modern thinker. And Rabbi Yosef Soloveitchik carries on a voice that comes from way, way earlier, and I show you how earlier, voices, some of which may stun you, because you would think that they come from a modern type of Judaism, maybe from Germany in the second half of the 19th century, the birthplace of Reform Judaism, and so on and so forth. I'll take you as early as 3rd century, Mishnaic, early Talmudic periods, and you'll see what they say. But look what Soloveitchik says. There are two types of Kedusha, sanctity, in Jewish life. A communal sanctity, which each individual Jew possesses by virtue of being a member in the Jewish community. And, look at this one, an individual sanctity, which recognizes each Jew as the direct recipient of Kedusha according to his, her own unique personal endowments, efforts, and achievements. Individual sanctity, he says, adds a personalistic element, a sanctification specific to the individual and unlike that found in anyone else. What do you take from this? Here we are, a bunch of Jews sitting around the same table. What is Soloveitchik actually saying here? And this is not an original Soloveitchik thought. It's a great Soloveitchik summary of earlier thoughts. What is, in fact, individual sanctity? What do you understand here?
Different interpretations
of what?
Understanding
what?
The laws.
So you're going straight to Judaism,
yeah.
to Jewish religion. Let's even unpack. Before we even go to Jewish life, here we are sitting here, a bunch of
individuals,
right? What is Soloveitchik saying is inherent to our condition?
We're different.
Are we all different?
Yes.
Everybody is equally different from everybody else? Well, you can measure it. Obviously, you cannot measure it. So, yeah, we are all different. If we are all different, we have one thing. We have one thing at least in common.
Right.
What
the
is
same that?
We are
the same
in the fact that we are different. In other words, the one thing we do have in common is that we are all different. No, that's what I'm saying. It's an individual sanctity. Now, I want you to understand individual sanctity. It's not just an individual sanctity. It's the sanctity of individualism. In other words, your individual uniqueness is a sanctified idea. And I'll show you in a minute from the Talmudic literature and the Mishnaic literature how it comes in a beautiful manner. But what I want us to understand, that goes back to what you said earlier, my dear, about theocracy, theopraxy and orthopraxy and orthodoxy. One of the things we will see here today, starting with Soloveitchik and going backwards, is that we shouldn't make the mistake of misconstruing unity for uniformity. And these are two very, very different things. Because what we can learn right here from the get-go is that one thing that unifies us as human beings is the fact that we have no uniformity in fact. In other words, we are unified by the fact that we are non-uniform. Just like when you look at time, at the property of time.
But where is that non-uniformity? That's
the question. Let's see. In a minute, we'll see. And we'll see how it presents itself according to these rabbinic texts. But right now, we're starting from a very interesting premise. Any allusion or illusion to the fact that we're supposed to think the same, aim for the same goals, understand the same things, or target the same concept is erroneous from the get-go because we lack the tools to do so. No one here can think for someone else or like someone else. So this myth is broken right from the get-go. I'm not supposed to think like you because you know what? The obvious, in my face, I'm not you. So now let's look at some excerpt that explain this, okay?
It's actually the supremely subversive idea. It comes out of a civilization where you get your identity from your family, your tribe, your the kingdom that you belong to, etc., etc.
Your God.
Exactly. It's all ascribed. You're born into it, and you have to somehow adapt. And this comes and turns the whole thing upside down, and it's the most modern of ideas. It says that reality really stems from the individual person. And then it's all out there for the individual. It's a fantastically subversive idea.
It is, and it's again, what you call subversive, I would assume that the early rabbis would call enlightened, something that came from God, another element that shows the beauty of God. And I'll show you in the verses how they glorify literally the name of God by this individual sanctity. It is subversive when you compare it now to modern times, and you say, this is incredible. The way postmodernism took something like this and turned it into a way of life in the Western world is really mind-boggling. What's important for me is that the seed of such ideas is definitely not a modern one.
The connection is the concept of
Bezalel. Absolutely. Bezalel, Bezel, being the shadow of, in the image of, and we'll see in a minute also how this uniqueness does not contradict the divine unity. Guys, flip the page. Let's look to the second source from Midrash Rabbah on Bamidbar 14:3. It is written. Moses spoke and God replied with a voice. You see it? This is a Midrash Rabbah, early rabbinic texts that were compiled on books of the Torah and some of them on different scrolls like Shir HaShirim, Eicha, and others. This is on one of the books of the Pentateuch, of the five books of Moses. And it interprets a very interesting interlude or exchange of an exchange between Moses and God on Mount Sinai. And it says there, Vaydaber Elohim im Moshe ke'achad ha'adam, and God spoke to Moses like a person speaks to another, which is immediately to a monotheistic mind. Remember, by the time we get to rabbis, you remember the first lecture I gave you, by the time we get to the rabbis, we're already monotheistic mind. So the idea of God speaking to a mortal like another person is obviously very disturbing. So they need to unpack this and take out the danger of polytheism, paganism out of it, right? So they immediately have to explain it. What does it mean when it says that God spoke and Moses answered with a voice, and Moses spoke and God answered with a voice? What does it mean God answered with a voice? It sounds so crude. It sounds so anthropomorphic, right? Look what the rabbis here do. It's really a brilliant midrash. It is written, Moses spoke and God replied with a voice, rather than God spoke and Moses replied with a voice. Why? Now it responds. Since when God replied to Moses, they say, God used Moses' own voice. Did you follow?
So he spoke through Moses.
He what?
He spoke through Moses.
Let me ask you a question. When Moses stood on Mount Sinai, according to these rabbis, what did Moses hear? His own voice. Coming from where exactly? From? Where did he hear it? In the landscape, in the structure? From the outside? What are the other possibilities?
From the inside.
If it says Moses' own voice, what is happening here? Could it be that the Mount Sinai that the rabbis are now trying to work through is not a Mount Sinai that is a physical landscape, but the Mount Sinai of the soul? What Moses is hearing is actually something that happens every human being 10,000 times a day. An enriched monologue, which we sometimes call a dialogue. Hearing myself. Getting into a dialogue or an enriched monologue with myself. I'm amplifying my most incredible desires, my most intimate wants, in a way that brings me closer to my potential.
Rabbi Nachman once did that really well.
In terms of
speaking.
Now I'll give you an example. What rabbis do, I don't give you those examples here, but rabbis ask the question, for example, how come that in certain parts of the Torah we find an angelic being or some sort of an intermediary referring to one of the patriarchs and calling them by name twice? Yitzchak, Yitzchak, Avraham, Avraham. Not Abraham or Avraham, Avraham. For example, in Genesis 22, when Abraham holds the knife and is about to put it to Isaac's neck, an angel comes from heaven and says, Avraham, Avraham, al tishlach yadcha el hanav. And some rabbis ask, why twice? Is it because he's deaf? Is it because he was so zealous to cut his son that he wanted, it was a pressing issue? They say no, they can't say something beautiful. They come and say, he heard his own voice calling him from heaven. So one Abraham talked to the other. One Jacob talked to the other. He locked into his divine potentiality. What the rabbis are suggesting here is in many ways a very intimate, profound, personal experience of divinity. Moses is hearing himself understanding the divine. It's not something that is objective, but it is something that is subjective. And it happened, if it happened to Moses through his human condition, there is a subliminal promise here, or at least a possibility. It could happen to you as well.
Isn't it today called in the modern world channeling?
It can be called in the modern world a lot of things. What I'm interested in is why did the rabbis write it in such a way over 1700 years ago? In other words, when they talked about Moses hearing something in his own voice, why is it important to take it into the human soul, into that subjective prism, if not in order to show that subjectivity is an integral part of the meaning-making process? You have something that Moses had as well. You're both humans. You both hear voices. And I love it, the idea of hearing voices. By the way, the rabbi of Piazetzner, if you heard that name, a great Hasidic rabbi, known as the Sfat Emet. He wrote the Sfat Emet. He said that one of the most cruel crimes that human beings make is hearing divine voices in their ears every day, telling them what they should do and how they should lead a righteous life, and aborting them like a mother who aborts a child willfully. Very stark language. Hapalat nefalim shel haneshama, he calls it. Very, very powerful language.
Is there, if you take the narrative, the Jewish narrative, there is also this period of, well, the collective revelation, where a collective and group of people who would see or actually heard the same thing.
And not at all.
Even if they heard it in a different way,
they didn't hear. First of all, they didn't hear anything.
They saw, which is a completely different story.
But what did they see?
They experienced, whatever it is that they experienced, that divine communion, connection, message, that then gets transferred into a sentence, which is the first.
I'll show you in a minute.
The first saying.
I'll show you in a minute. that even the Mount Sinai event is not perceived in classical Judaism as an event that everyone saw the same way, and that is the reason for that is the reason behind.
They didn't respond.
They didn't hear the same thing. They didn't hear the same thing. We'll get there.
No, but what I don't understand is when you translate it into a document that has to then formalize whatever that they heard or seen into a sentence, which is Hashem, Ani Hashem Elokecha. Okay. That is like they should. It should have been gibberish. It should have, if it was not something of a consensus of what they heard, they shouldn't. They should not have put it down in any case. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that they did. So, I don't understand that.
I'll show you.
It's not the rest, but that particular saying, the first, well, some people said the first one, the first two, I mean, but there was a consensus that they saw it or heard it or experienced it collectively.
No.
The saying.
There was a consensus that they were all there. There's a very big difference. There was a consensus that the people of Israel were present at the time of the revelation at Sinai, that they witnessed that something happened. Depends who you ask. That's why I told you guys, Judaism doesn't talk. Jews do. I can show you books that say that the thing that they heard in Sinai was the Aleph, the breath of the Aleph of the Anuchi. And the rest is commentary. And others that would say, no. All the Torah, all the truth that are revealed and are bound to be revealed to all the sages until the Messianic era were already revealed in the first sentence. And we're heard by all of the Israelites together. It depends who you ask. What I'm telling you here, and I'll show you in the text why we light two Shabbat candles. Although according to Halakha you can light anything up to 1,000. I'll show you why two. And it answers exactly your question. There is a difference between what God said and what we heard. And when it comes to the human applicability of what God said, the question is no longer what did God say. Is that what did we hear? And that's how the rabbis, for example, and I'll show you, deal with the apparent contradiction in the Torah itself, where one version said that God said in Sinai, Shamor et Yom HaShabbat, safeguard the Sabbath day. It says so. According to your logic, you would say that's what God said. And in another place, the same verse says, Zachor. There isn't a statement that the Torah says that they all heard. There isn't a single statement.
They told him, you go up and now get the rest of the Torah, right?
Yeah.
So the first saying.
What first saying? Yeah, they didn't hear it as well. There's no document. There's no place where. Where? Show me. In the Torah, the people of Israel don't hear. The people of Israel themselves don't hear anything from the Ten Commandments as a community. Everything you're talking about from the Bible, from the Torah, everything you said up to this point is rabbinic midrashim. And I can show you other midrashim that say the exact opposite. But there is no place in the Torah that says that the entire people hear Anuchi Adonai Elohecha. They hear a noise, and then there is a kol dmama daka, a still sound voice, whatever that means. But there is no statement or utterance from divinity that is heard as a community by the people of Israel. You can check it. Let us continue. But you can go go to Mazeh Shmot Tzayin. Exodus 17, I think. Don't check it. Maybe. Okay. Now let's look, guys, at page 3. Let's look at the next one, which is from the Mishnah Sanhedrin 4, one of the favorite. It's a fantastic verse that you should all get to know. From Mishnah Sanhedrin 4, look at this. In order to demonstrate the glory of the King of all kings, God, see how, remember that the verse is written in a context, Mishnaic period, the Roman world, right? So they say, see how the emperor stamps many coins with the same imprint and they all look alike. This goes to what you said about image, Tselem. Yet the King of all kings, God, blessed be He, stamped each man with the imprint of the primordial Adam. Yet each looks different. Therefore, each person must declare, this entire world was created for me. Bishvili nivra haolam. Now guys, let me ask you a question. Is that a selfish act? to come and say now, Bishvili Nivra Olam? The whole world was created for me. How do you understand it? First of all, it puts a great sense of responsibility on you. But before we even go to responsibility, what does it tell you about yourself and your relationship with the world? Unique, and that means what? And that means what about? And that means what about the way you perceive the world? Ah, the number of worlds equals the number of those who see them. Guys, look around you. Look around us in this table. How many of us are here? 17, 18? I'm talking about physics. I'm not talking about the other. Everybody here sees the world, the entire world, from their own angle at every given moment in space and time. No one sees the same world as you at any point of your life until we die. I just want you to understand, we all live to a certain extent in our own existential island. No one shares it. Ever. Ever. Once you start entertaining that thought, it can first of all get incredibly lonely. But second, it's invigorating. And then you get to the point of, wow, I am truly awesome. I'm using awesome here, not in the American popular way. Awesome, in the fuller sense of the word. There is no one like me, period. Talking about being an image of the one and only God, when you understand that you are one and only as well. But look what it does here. It comes and says, although you're unique, you were all of us were stamped by the same divine imprint. In other words, it does exactly what the other Midrash did. It says, there is no uniformity among us, but there is a unity that informs our diverse appearance. And just as we are different in the way we look. Look at Midrash Rabbah on Numbers. Ah, what a beautiful blessing. This is a blessing that every Jew must know. Must. If there's something I want you to take away from all our classes, is this blessing. Teach it to others. Upon seeing a multitude of people, in this case Jews, one should recite the following. It's known in Hebrew as Birkat Chacham Harazim. Blessed are you, God, master of all secrets. For just as their faces are different, so their opinions differ from one to the other, and each is entitled to his or her own mind. Guys, Midrash Rabbah. Baruch ata Hashem chacham kol arazim, keshem she'en parzufehen domin ze laze, kach gam en da'atan doma ze laze, vekol echad yesh lo de'a bifnei atzmo. That's the exact quote. My friend, 3rd century Palestine. Where did it vanish? Where did it vanish? Okay? Now look at this Midrash Rabbah, the same Midrash Rabbah. Look what it says now to Moses. To Moses, the same Moses who heard the divine voice in his own head. His subjectivity being this most beautiful prism that guided a nation. Look what Moses says before his death. According to Midrash, right? This is not Torah. Before his death, Moses pleaded with God, saying, Lord of the universe, the mind and soul of each of your creatures is revealed to you. And you know that your children's mind and souls differ from one to the other. Before I depart, heed my plea and find them a leader who will treat each of them according to his or her own temperament. Guys, individual sanctity, individual attitude to reality, the individual makeup of each Jew in this attempt to create a harmonious Jewish life, is part and parcel of the evolution of Judaism. What I want to remind you now is that only once you make the mistake of misinterpreting unity as uniformity, Then when dogma, at that point, dogma enters the stage.
When did the ultra-Orthodox stray away from this? I mean, because everything...
It's not, I don't want to call names, because to say that it's ultra-Orthodox is an incredibly, it will be, it will be incredible injustice.
When did they stray away from it? They all look the same.
They did not stray away from it. There is an integral part, there is a need in the human mind, in human discourse, to try and create dogmas. There is a need in the human mind to close your mind. There is a need to know the path and do just that. Every theological structure has those kinds of people, and I don't want to undermine their importance. And I don't want to oversimplify their theology. Ultra-Orthodoxy, again, there is no such thing as one unified ultra-Orthodoxy. Anybody who knows a little bit about them knows that they are as disparate from each other as any other branch in Judaism. And the battles between them, you can write books on them. Just like there is no one orthodoxy, there are those who will try to persuade you and others, but mainly themselves, that they are the result of the right path. That's a human need. What I'm trying to show you today, guys, is that this notion of diversity and pluralism is embedded within the evolution of Judaism from a very early stage. That this perception that the rabbis thought that everybody is ignorant, that they should be able to come to terms with one idea and to do one thing, is not necessarily correct. Now, I do want to make the distinction between what you called orthodoxy and orthopraxy, because that's an important distinction. But now we're talking about applicable truth and not absolute truth. And applicable truth doesn't have anything to do with the mind of God. We already discussed that. Okay, so I want us to remember now. If we talk about the mind of God now, and about the role of man or the human in the mind of God, we come to a completely new place. Diversity is part and parcel of the theological intent. You were created unique, because it is only through that uniqueness that we can eventually celebrate the fuller scope of the divine potential. So now I want us to flip the page back to page 2 and look at a wonderful Hasidic story or a folk tale. You say, well, it says individual sanctity? There is a story here at the center. Rabbi Ber of Radovich once said to his teacher, the Seer of Lublin. Have you heard about the Seer of Lublin? Achozemi Lublin, one of the great sages of the early Hasidic period. Show me one general way to the service of God. Now, guys, had I stopped this, most people who are not familiar, say Hasidism, they're all dressed, you just said it. They dress the light, they look the light, da-da-da-da-da-da. You say, okay, I'll show you one way to worship God, and this is look at the answer. The tzaddik replied, it is impossible to tell men what way they should take. For one way to serve God is through learning, another through prayer, another through fasting, and still another through eating. Everyone should carefully observe what way his heart draws him to, and then choose this way with all his strength. In other words, what does this Hasidic folte tell us about meaning making? Where does meaning come from? From the individual and from? From the inside. It's an inner mechanism. This is why I think there is a beautiful way of making the analogy between the Mount Sinai of the mind and the Mount Sinai of the land. This objective communal event, which is part of our narrative, but once you go deeper, the call for each individual to aspire to become the Moses of their own lives, to climb that mountain. And I want to remind you something beautiful about the Mount Sinai event. Something which I find beautiful. It is a God who tells you, if you climb, if you make the effort to climb, I'll make the effort to descend. There is something beautiful about Mount Sinai. It is a midway. God doesn't ask you to let go of humanity and become divine. And God doesn't ask itself to become human. It meets you halfway. It says, if you make the effort and climb, I'll make the effort and come down and will meet on top of Mount Sinai. Therefore, the tallest or the highest point on earth in that respect is not Mount Everest, but rather the tallest person who stood on top of Mount Everest.
What is the effort?
To climb.
What is climbing?
In my opinion, the climbing
that actually creates that connection where we're being met.
The climbing.
Delving the
Again, depends who you ask. Depends who you ask. For me, when I hear climbing, it's really to, first of all, a lot of we can talk about the symbolism of that for its lecture unto itself. But the idea of coming face to face alone with divinity, in my opinion, is that point where you really let go of the masks, let go of the noise, let go of the very rich world which you have created for yourself in order to distract yourself from the true questions of life. And getting to a point where silence, by virtue of being silent, can deafen you for eternity. Now, you know, I'll give you an example. Somebody said it once. I don't remember who, but it's definitely not mine. So I'm quoting someone else. He said the following thing. He said, people are very scared to leave the comfortable and the known and to either climb or sail to a new land, to a promised land. It's very scary. But there is a point that is scarier than the point of leaving the known, of sira basar, that pot of meat and that the Israelites said to Moses, we are left with nothing. There is one point that is even scarier than that. It's that point in the middle where you no longer see the land from whence you came, yet you have no conceivable knowledge of the land to which you're going to go. In other words, at this point, you're truly naked. And that's a leap of faith. Where do you go? Do you go back or do you move on? At this juncture, the mountain, that you're really naked. And I find it fascinating that Mount Sinai happens at such a juncture. Where you're naked. You left. You're not going back. You still have no idea where is that promised land, if you're ever going to make it, if you're going to die in the process. Now, the real questions about life come to bear. And I really believe that in meaningful, that human beings, if they are honest, everybody has to climb their Mount Sinai. They have to. You have no choice.
Can I ask something? Why is it the text? See, I'm just reading the text.
Yeah.
It says here that God says that people, tells Moses to instruct the people not to climb the mountain, not to approach the mountain, to set boundaries around the mountain. And he repeats it again and again and again. So somehow there is a contradiction. I mean, there is not a contradiction. There could be. You are saying be your own Moses. In other words, become the Moses. But
in
also
Europe,
we are told there is one Moses that would have, there is only one Moses, and there will always be only one Moses forever and ever.
Right.
So, where do you get this idea that we should climb Mount Sinai?
First of all, I get this idea from the very notion that I accept the Torah, not necessarily as a divine word, but I accept the Torah as a multifaceted text. You're doing what? So I'm looking at it as a multifaceted text. So I'm coming and saying there are many levels of appreciation of the text of that. I find it a very profound text. I'm not looking at this a secular way, but And for example, the way I come and say, how about if the Torah suggests to us, and by the way, I'm not original in what I'm saying. What about if the Torah suggests to us two stories that run parallel to each other and they're bound by the same narrative or by the same words? You know, there's a depth here, like a matrix.
Yeah.
And if you read the pshat, you see there is one mountain, one Moses, hears voices, blah, 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 coming down, giving them to the people, it's all nice. If you go deeper, I can take exactly the same command that God says, tell the others not to climb the mountain, come and say, maybe they don't need to. Maybe they don't have to be distracted by a real mountain, but rather focus on their own mountain. Maybe God says to them, do not fool the landscape of the soul by distracting yourself with the landscape of the world, which is what we always do. Okay, interpretation. I'm just giving you an offer. All I'm saying is there are multiple ways of looking at the same text. The assumption you are making, however, and I want to put it, is dangerous. And that assumption is that there is a single interpretation that may point to the mind of God here.
No, if you said... I didn't know that. I'm open to hear.
No, I'm not saying... If there is an assumption that there is one truth, all I'm saying is...
Multiple, and actually, they could be even further if you take it.
70 is just a random number. Right. But you understand where I'm coming from. I'm telling you this not as an intellectual exercise. I'm telling you this because it is embedded in the way rabbis understand Torah. It is really a matrix. They understand Torah as a text that is, I discussed this with you. I told a divinity cloaked in language, if you remember we talked. That you can truly understand in different manners and speaks to you on different level based on your level of understanding. The text itself is meaningless. The only prism through which it can assume meaning is through your eyes and through your heart. And just like the Chinese proverb says, a person never enters the same river twice. The Jewish version of that is a person never reads the same Torah twice. The Torah hasn't changed. You have. That's what I'm talking about. So I just gave you an example of how to read the same text and extrapolate.
Actually, it stems from a question that you ask yourself, because you often have a question, why did God tell them not to? When you attempt to answer that question, why did they not have to?
Which you could. Absolutely. Of course you could. Absolutely. And it would be wrong.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now remember what we said about meaning as a process that comes from the inside? Not something that comes from, I'm using now the Mount Sinai outside, everybody hears, everybody gets it, like, let's get to work. But rather, an inside process that if you followed my line of thinking up to this point, you can understand that if it's an inside process, and each one of us is an individual, obviously the process that we undergo is individual. So we already have a problem in negotiating between our individual worlds and the public domain. But first, I want you to see that this idea of this individuality is part and parcel of classic rabbinism. And I want you to see Rabbi Bachya ibn Pakuda in his work, classical work, Duties of the Heart. Look what he writes about this verse from Proverbs 25. Page 2, under the Hasidic Folte. The designs in a man's heart are like deep waters. That shouldn't surprise you if you remember our class on Hebrew. You remember why the words that are used is both for wisdom and water. We discussed this, so you shouldn't be surprised. And a man of understanding shall draw them out. Now look what Bachya ibn Pakuda says. The meaning of the above verse is that wisdom is implanted in man's nature, in his character and in his powers of perception, like the waters that are hidden in the depth of the earth. The intelligent and discerning man will try to tap into his own inner potential. Look at this language. It's not that discerning man will consult God or the priests. Tap into his own inner potential for wisdom, uncover it and bring it to expression, drawing it out of his own heart, much like the search for water in the depth of the earth. Okay? Now, so here's a question for you. If each and every one of us is individual, and there's one thing we have in common, and that is that we're different. How do we become one? What does Judaism mean? Are there as many Judaisms as there are Jews? Should we let go of the term Judaism as a nonsense, as a myth, as a word that we use that has virtually no meaning?
Yeah. Respect the other and be unified in respecting the other and recognizing the individual and the godliness and the sanctity in the other individual, but not seeing the small image, but just respecting.
You know,
But respect is not enough. I don't need just to respect you is politeness. It's political correctness. I'm talking about creating a community. What is the communal value of respect?
Well, we have the commandments which
the Muslims. Who is we? You said we.
Yeah.
Who is we?
Those Jews.
Well, you already made five assumptions here. I'm asking you now, I don't want this argument to become tautological, my dear. You have to unpack the words you're using here in order to answer my question. I said now we have 18 of us, and according to what I showed you so far, there are literally 18 of us. Each one of us is an existential island. I'm now trying to build a bridge that connects each and every one of us in a meaningful way, in a truthful way, not just because we need each other, a truthful way. How do I build a true bridge between us which gives us any kind of language and meaning to say, okay, it's not just 18 Jews, because 18 Jews means nothing, because then I cannot know what Judaism Jew means to you and it means nothing. So as far as I'm concerned, you can call yourself something else and I'll call myself something else. But rather, I come and say, if you say we Jews, Jew is already a family name. It's not a private name. My name is Zohar, my family name is Jew. So is your family name a Jew? So we are a family. Now I ask you, what constitutes that communal aspect?
If you look at the human body, and you understand the human body as an assemblage of cells, and then organs, etc., etc. So you see that every organ has got its own function, or every cell belongs to a particular organ. But together, they constitute a human body. What makes them part of the human body? That they serve one unified purpose, which is to keep you alive.
What makes us all? What makes us all have unity?
But what if somebody doesn't abide by this purpose?
What's making the 18 of us feel some sense of unity?
Well, we all unite.
We're all interested in
ourselves as a body.
So wait, so you talk about a common interest.
We have a common interest.
Okay, what else?
A common goal or a common challenge or something.
Well, we all uniquely perceive our experiences in our own universes and our world. We're each affecting in some, like, the action I personally will take. Like, I can jump up on the table and start screaming and disrupt this. And you're going to perceive it individually differently than everyone else, but I'm affecting you. No matter what I choose to do, I'm going to affect you. And if I'm absolutely unique, no one's ever been like me, no one is like me, no one ever will be like me, there's only one, like there's something that I only uniquely can bring to the communal experience. Everyone will experience it in some way. So I see that as that is the connection.
Anybody wants to carry that thought further?
Like was saying about the respect, I think it's like that golden rule, because the self is so sanctified, you want to see the self in the other somehow.
Okay, so if the self is sanctified, then by extension, every self is sanctified. Fantastic. So that point number one. If I understand my self as holy, that means that by definition, every self is holy. So actually, the sanctification of the self is a selfless act. That's number one. More. Very good. So now we have a little breakthrough out of this existential island. What else? We built... Okay, absolutely. Absolutely. We'll ask about Judaism as well. But you're right. Because what we're dealing with is a Jewish class. But I'm asking you a question that can pertain to any element between you and any other communal structure. But how does it work between us? How does it work? Now let's work horizontal, guys. I showed you axis mundis. I said that it's theological. Now, horizontal. You gave me one reasoning, which is fantastic. You said, if I sanctify myself, I have to, by default, sanctify everybody else. So now I sanctified my human landscape. The human landscape around me is sanctified. Everybody is unique. If everybody is unique, what stems from that? You already stumbled on it. or picked on it, not stumbled. You take us in that direction. If everyone is sacred and everyone is unique, what does their presence mean about me, or tell me, or can do for me? How? They can give me what? Of what? That's nice. More. I want to push you more. Ah, fantastic. Fantastic. If everyone is unique, everybody can give me something that no one else can give me, including myself. In other words, my friends, taken ad infinitum, every encounter with another human being is potentially a profound learning experience. If taken ad infinitum, you have to be very alert, very aware. It's exhausting. But I'm talking about potential. In other words, every moment that you spend with another human being, you spend it with someone who sees the world inherently different than you. Now I wanted to take us to a Jewish lens on this issue. And you said before, what did we hear in Sinai? Here is a fantastic example. Go to page number 4. Communal sanctity as a Jewish backbone. Now we move from individual sanctity that Soloveitchik talked about, and he also talked about communal sanctity. And here is a wonderful example. On Exodus 20, verse 8, we read, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy." Zachor et yom ha-shabbat lekodesho. In Deuteronomy, that recants or gives us another version of what had happened in Sinai, it says, safeguard Shamor et Yom HaShabbat to keep it holy. The rabbis now ask a very meaningful question. What was said in Sinai? Or better yet, remember what I just told you? The question is not what was said in Sinai, but rather what was heard in Sinai. And then they go to the book of Psalms and quote, this is a beautiful midrash in the making. One word God has spoken, two words have I heard. In Psalms it says, Achat diber Elohim, Shtaim zu shamati. So, there is a difference between the divine word and the human ear. And what do they say now? This is from the Siddur. We recite this on Friday night services. Zachor v'shamor bedibur echad, Yishmi'anu elam yuchad. Adonai echad ushmo echad, leshem ultiferet ulitila lecha dodi. Remember? Okay? Zachor v'shamor medibur echad, which Rabbi Shlomo Elkabetz put in his lecha dodi, he took it from the Siddur that was put there by the earlier sages. The Siddur took it from those earlier sages who now argued what was heard in Mount Sinai and how can we negotiate the two words that seem to discuss the same thing. There is a problem. Did God say Zachor or did God say Shamor? How do they solve it? Don't ask what God said. Ask what people heard. And what people heard? A fantastic thing. Half the community around Mount Sinai heard Zachor et Yom HaShabbat. The other half heard Shamor et Yom HaShabbat. And now, and that goes to what you said, in order to get the fuller picture of Jewish life, one must expand beyond their selfish individual understanding of Jewish life. In other words, in order for me to fulfill that commitment or commandment, I must ask you, what did you hear on the other side of the mountain? Let me explain again. The idea of individual sanctity, by extension, has to brush itself against the idea of communal sanctity. And with that individual subjectivity and sanctity also come an inherent limitation. You're a unique individual. You are not a holistic creature. You need other Jews in order to come closer to the Jewish holistic mind frame. I have to consult you about the way you understand Judaism, because by coming into dialogue with you, and in a minute I'll explain what dialogue means here, by coming into dialogue with you and with you, it informs my lens about my Jewish life. I'm not doing you a favor. I want you to understand here. A dialogue is not the political correctness or the politically correct embrace of another in the name of politeness, of giving you the space to speak your mind and say, yeah, thank you for talking, let's continue. No. It means becoming involved in the life of another under the assumption that that life, that lens, that view may or might change the way you perceive your Jewish self. A dialogue in that lens, my friend, is taking a risk. Being pushed beyond your zone of Jewish comfort. That's a dialogue. That's communal sanctity. Understanding now that being a Jew means to extend or expand beyond the boundaries of your Jewish self. It is a communal experience where one brings to bear their individual take on it and allows other individuals to come into dialogue with them and share their lens. And what you see might change the way I see, and what I see might change the way you see. In other words, be careful, you might learn something. And vice versa. It is a risk. That's why it's so scary.
But that's what you would define
a Jew as? I'm sorry?
That's how
I would define an individual sanctity put in the correct Jewish context. That's why I said individual sanctity cannot be understood. That's why Soloveitchik, when he talks, he said two types of dusha. If you remain only with individual sanctity, you haven't done anything. But that's a selfish act. But if you come and say individual sanctity within the communal sanctity, that's a selfless act, because then you sanctify each individual and you allow them a platform to share with you their inherent view. That's precisely what Chevruta aims to be. Aims to be. That's precisely what the dialogue aims to be. It's not a monologue of deaf people. One says what they believe, another one says what they believe. And sometimes, guys, what we call a dialogue in the Western world is many times, let's be honest here, is a monologue or two monologues. At best, they're very polite to one another. They listen. That's not what I call a dialogue here. A dialogue here is the risk-taking that you might change your mind in result of listening to another person. Now that's scary. Talking about climbing Sinai, talking about being transformed by another person, that's scary.
It's also exciting.
Absolutely. If you're able to really move beyond your individual sanctity and the ego that comes with it. First of all, I never said that it's only Jewish. What I'm showing you is how Jewish voices deal with that concept. I would definitely encourage you to go and investigate how other religious systems and theologies deal with it. I would believe, based on my very limited knowledge of other theologies, that there are certain theologies that do much more work on this issue because their theological structure is also more pluralistic. I think what is fascinating, for example, Eastern systems, Eastern theologies deal much more on individual sanctity because it corresponds very well with their theological pantheon. Different people also correspond with different deities. They deal with them. They work with them. So this idea of pluralistic structure is not even foreign to the theological notion. What I find fascinating about Judaism here is that you're talking about a monotheistic system that would assume, that's why I started saying, if it's monotheistic, there is one way and one God and one mind, you should assume that there will be an orthodoxy and an orthopraxy, that there's one God says one thing. You should do one thing. End of story. This is what God wants from you. And I show you exactly the opposite. The one God not only does not negate the many voices, but rather advocate in their favor. And that's the point I want to take you. Do not confuse the unity of God in Jewish life with the multiplicity of God's expressions in this world.
But then what's so ironic is when you see the practical manifestations, whether from Orthodox or Reform or Conservative, is that everyone is linked to it.
First of all, not everyone. Far from it. And again, guys, if you learned anything from these lectures, is I hope that you stop generalizing. It's the easiest tendency. There isn't such a thing as Judaism. There isn't such a thing as Jewish Orthodox people. Just as there isn't such an entity as Jewish secular people or Reform people. I found people who are Reform or secular and are as narrow-minded and far more narrow-minded than some Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox people that I found that are eager for a meaningful dialogue and are willing to risk their own beliefs on the shrine of a meaningful intellectual debate with another Jew. So first of all, let us get rid of that necessity that we have or tendency that we have to put people in the same rubric. It doesn't work. It makes our lives very easy, but it's not real. There are those in every stream. I'll give you an example. Take Israel. Israel is a very, very Orthodox country. And when I say Orthodox country, I mean that many of its religious people are very Orthodox in their beliefs, just as we have a very Orthodox secular movement in Israel. Incredibly Orthodox. Ultra-Orthodox. They will have nothing to do with religion. Everything about religion is wrong. It's all mukzeh. I want nothing to do with it. This is my way. My dear, if you take it to the bottom line, this guy is as ultra-Orthodox as this ultra-Orthodox. So what are we talking about? Let's be honest. People feel much more comfortable putting themselves in a place and saying, I'm right, and by definition, by being right, you're wrong. But I'm trying to show you that once you investigate, and that's, I think, by the way, I'll say it here, this is what I think is so beautiful also about Alma, and other Batei Midrashot who do such work. They come and reflect to you, first of all, they try to reflect to you a Jewish way of thinking that is very different than what so many Jews believe is what Judaism is. That's why I say one of our major problems in the modern world, just as it used to be for hundreds of years, is not that people disagree. It's that people are literally ignorant. And they are built on preconceived assumptions that sometimes have very little, if at all, to do with the truth. You know how many people I find in years who are shocked to believe that there is such a concept as pluralism in rabbinic Judaism? Say it runs counter to anything I ever believed is true. So, well, welcome. Or, what, you want to tell me that there were rabbis who actually wanted others to learn and share? Well.
Yeah, this is one thing that bothers me about our conversation. It's very reinforcing and encouraging to discover all this pluralism in the earliest sources of Judaism, and for me it's fantastic. But at the same time, we know that in order for a people and a tradition to have continuity over time, we cannot ignore the issue of what are the components of continuity.
Mm-hmm.
How do you set borders? Because unfortunately, setting and defining borders is an inescapable function of any group that wants to survive.
To identify itself. To identify, absolutely.
So that's what takes you, and even if we just said for a quick shorthand that one of the reasons we're living in an age when this pluralism is so chassid, so absent, we'd love to have it, we're like thirsty for it. So maybe that's because of the challenges that modernity placed in front of Judaism and caused this reaction of defensiveness and so on. And maybe that's the difference between Ashkenazi and Sephardic, all that stuff. But it still leaves us, and I've never solved this for myself, it still leaves us, if we want to be serious, with trying to figure out how to get the full equation. In Rav Soloveitchik's terminology, how to get the communal side operating in a way that not only interacts with the individual and subjective side, but even amplifies it and explains to us that it's okay, and yet gives us the tools that we need
You already answered your question. You already answered your question.
Well, I must have missed it.
Guys, look. The whole idea here is to take individual sanctity as an element that enforces you, that gives you, empowers you to come to the table in order to dialogue and be an active component of the community that decides what kind of life it wants to lead. That's exactly what I'm telling you. The halachic endeavor. And what is the halachic process? Guys, we read it yet. We read it last... It wasn't even last week. It was 3 days ago because we have this Sunday today, session today. What did we read? You remember Bet Shammai and Bet Hillel? What were they concerned about? They were concerned about, not about the ruling itself. They couldn't care less about the ruling. You see, the Brashni Lagat, halacha is according to Hillel. But then they ask the question, why according to Hillel? And they say, not because Hillel understood the mind of God. It's because Hillel... Now, tap into this, my friend. Not just listen to the other. He came into dialogue with them. They reverted their decision. Now, what happened in result of that change? Halacha came forth. Now came the boundary. The boundary is not a limitation necessarily. It depends on how you look at it. The boundary of communal life could be the result of a meaningful dialogue between Jews who now see it as their own responsibility to articulate what kind of a boundary they want around themselves. Absolutely. That's why I said, guys, the problem we have is twofold. One, many Jews who do not understand the concept of individual sanctity and they get lost in the shuffle in silence. They get lost. They don't join the table for a dialogue. Either they don't have the knowledge or worse, they don't have the inclination or worse, they don't see the relevance of it. They don't see Jewish life as a relevant component of meaning-making processes. One. Second, modern Western world understands individualism devoid of any communal commitment. I'm not talking about this kind of individualism, my friend. I'm talking about the Jewish version of individualism, which always, always has to be understood within the context of communal sanctity. Otherwise, it has nothing to do with the Jewish value of individual sanctity. The notion is, I'm saying I'm sacred, but I'm part of something that is bigger than me. And my sanctity can come to full expression only when brushed against other voices. Guys, look, not me, look at Franz Rosenzweig, Martin Buber, people far smarter than myself. Look at what they say. The oneness of the center is not something that we possess clearly and ambiguously, not something we can articulate about. We must search for this, middle of page 4. We must search for this oneness and have faith that we shall find it. Look, he's talking about this unity. Seen from the periphery, however, the center does not invariably the same. In fact, the center of the circle looks different from each point of the periphery. By the way, you know when he said this? 1922, in the opening of the House of Jewish Learning in Hamburg. Exactly, as part of the Wissenschaft des Judentums. Look what he says! Look what he says! He says from the periphery, this center looks different to each person. One of the exercises I do with students, by the way, when we talk about Mount Sinai, I put the Shema Israel in a tube. I take a cardboard and I turn it into a tube. I write the Shema Israel like this. I put them in a circle and I tell them, tell me what you see. Without talking to your neighbor, just write down what you see. What do you get? 50 fragments of the Shema. And then I tell them, I want you now as a group to write down the full Shema. They have to come into dialogue. They have to talk to one another. They can't leave their seat. I tell them, that's Mount Sinai. That's communal revelation. If you don't tell me what you see on your side, I will never be able to decipher the verse in its full, and vice versa. I need you to inform my Jewish identity. For me, a Jew alone, or the last of Jews, if you like that, the last of the Mohicans, is a paradox. For me, a Jew alone is a paradox. It's a non-existing entity. Oh, Moses heard it with his own voice. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Trust me, a Jew has his mind, he has enough to argue with. Okay, the same thing with Martin Buber, a contemporary, a good friend of Franz Rosenzweig. All men have access to God, but each man has a different access. Mankind's great chance lies precisely in the unlikeness of man, in the unlikeness of their qualities and inclinations. And then one of the greatest scholars of the modern era, Gershom Scholem, who was a very close friend of Martin Buber, look what he says. Tradition is a reflective impulse that intervenes between the absoluteness of the divine word, revelation, whatever that was, and its receiver. The absolutely concrete is, at the same time, the simply unfulfillable. It is that which in no way can be put into practice. So what can be put into practice? Let's read it again, if you didn't. Let's read it again. Page 4, bottom of page 4. Tradition is the reflective impulse that intervenes between the absoluteness of the divine word, revelation, God said something, and its receiver. So what is tradition? In many ways, tradition is our own main access mundi. Because the absolutely concrete, the divine word, this thing that is absolute, is at the same time the divine voice, the divine word. Oh, tradition is the masorah, what we do, what we say, what we do, what we agree on. Guys, in other words, tradition.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
The absolute
concretely means the divine word, what God actually said. It's unfulfilled. It's not there. It's not in the human realm. It's not what we deal with. We deal with the applicable truth. We deal with that which we can handle in our own limited minds. Tradition becomes a prism to make us a little bit more closer to God, but without letting us lose sight of the fact that we're humans. And yes, because the infinity of God's mind is a fabulous philosophical idea, but in a religious realm, it's unfulfillable. Now you can understand it within the context that I've given you. It's unfulfillable. There's nothing I can do with the mind of God. Once I ask myself, tachlis, how am I to translate it, I already submit myself to human limitation. And if I... Yeah, you want me to unpack this for you in a minute, like the rabbis did? What happens if two Levites tell you two contradictory things? What do you do? Who said?
Eventually, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who you choose. If it's anyway, it's a small truth. But there has to be consensus.
There has to be.
A consensus on the action.
There has to be an agreement on a halachic ruling.
Yeah. Sorry.
Okay, not a consensus.
No, you're right.
Okay, so that's a different thing. And then you do that. Right? But then again, it's binding until it changes.
Yeah, but until it changes, as with a
halachic ruling.
With a halachic ruling.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. So, there's nothing absolute
about
tradition.
No, there's nothing.
Okay? The only absolute about tradition is that it's subject to change.
This crisscrosses with the issues of two other concepts.
Today I brought you Achnai's oven, guys. I promised you.
Authority and legitimacy.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the critical places where we really start to split up into a thousand little pieces, and where we go at each other's throats, and we forget, the point of the whole exercise, and where we reach our ugliest are the disputes over authority and legitimacy. Maybe it's because of a massive loss of self-confidence. Maybe we were much better when we could rely on our individual subjectivity and our inner Har Sinai and all that. And maybe in this day and age, because of whatever it is, we're no longer capable of that. So we have to fight each other. And my authority and legitimacy is better than yours.
In so many words, I think that the problem is that Jews today, especially in the Western communities, understand individual sanctity as a value that comes from the modern world, from the modern secular world. It is the product of liberalism, modernism, rationalism, secularism, anthropocentrism, elements that have nothing to do with Jewish values in the traditional sense. This is why I call this lecture Pluralism and the Evolution of Judaism, not from a Western secular mindset. The individual sanctity I'm talking about has nothing to do with the secular Americanized individual sanctity that so many people speak in favor of, and so many of our own students grow and bask at that light. That's not what I'm talking about, because that kind of individualism, with all of its advantages, comes with one great disadvantage. It has completely robbed away the sense of communal relations, any kind of communal commitment. Now, that goes to the question that you raise now. If Judaism, in traditional sense, had communal authority, where does that go when there is no longer a community to speak for? Nobody can now come and say, look, on behalf of the community, I want you to abide by certain rulings. Nobody can, anybody, and no one can anymore come to somebody and say, look, you're not Jewish. According to these definitions of our community, you don't follow. Because they will come and say to you, look, Judaism for many young Jews became a cardiac experience. It's a cardiac experience. I feel Jewish. I woke up in the morning, the sun is shining, the birds are singing, and I'm Jewish. Who are you to tell me that I'm not? Mi samcha, right? On whose authority can you tell me that I'm not Jewish? My response to that is say, look, with all due respect, you can take a glass of water and you can wake up in the morning and I can look at my wife and say, you know what, I woke up in the morning and I really feel that this is a great cup of tea. I really feel it. Do you want to argue with me? No, but you know what? It has no color. It has no taste. It has no tachlis to it. If you want to call it a cup of tea, by all means. But I cannot come into a dialogue with you about the meaning of this cup of tea. So don't misunderstand for a second that when I talk about individual sanctity, I'm talking about a free-for-all enterprise where everybody can venture their own way and say, I'm Jewish and nobody can tell me otherwise. Anybody who does that misunderstands the whole thing. I'm talking about individual sanctity in order to, first of all, take responsibility for your life and bring this sanctity into fruition, which means go and study, bring some knowledge into the table, bring yourself into the table and allow us to get to know who you are, realizing that it's both. Look, you gave it before, you said Tzelem. Rabbis come and say that Adam, the human, was created as Chelek Eloa Mimal, as part of God above. This is a good example. When you say Chelek Eloa Mimal, in Judaism all the time, you see it in liturgy, you see it in practice also, we negotiate grandeur and humility at the same time. I'll give you a few examples. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam asher kitshanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu. Anyone who speaks Hebrew can immediately see that there's something weird here. We speak, first of all, in the second tense, Baruch atah Adonai, and immediately we move to the third tense, asher kitshanu v'tzivanu. We don't say asher kidashtanu v'tzivatanu. No, asher kitshanu v'tzivanu. Asher kitshanu v'higyanu v'hem. Why do we move from the second to the third in the same blessing? Do you ever think about it? It's exactly the same reason that we come and say, when we start Tfilat Amidah, Tfilat Shmona Esrei, we go like this, closer to God, and immediately far away. It's exactly like when we recite the Shmona Esrei, and we say, Kadosh, 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 we come close to God, right? Kadosh, 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 Adonai Tzevaot, we come close, immediately come away. The same way with the Hebrew. Baruch Atah Adonai, and then I avert my eyes. I'm not that close to you. I stand, I bow, I stand again. I come closer to you and then I bow. I talk, I change the language so I don't talk to you directly. Everything about Jewish liturgy comes and talks about this grandeur and humility at the same time. You are great by being part of God above. The whole world was created for you. I just showed you. Grandeur. Wow. I'm part of God above. At the same time, you are reminded you're only part of God above. Chill. Right? It depends how you read it. Wow, and? Okay. That's what I'm talking about. You are part of God above, individual. You're part of God above, communal. Bring those two together, and you talk about a formula that still requires perfection, but guess what? It required perfection in each and every generation. The scary thing starts when certain individuals start to speak in a communal voice on their own behalf. That's when it can get worrisome, and there are people like that all the time as well. So humility.
Why do we call this Jewish? Why do we call this Jewish?
First of all, it's because it's definitely not modern. The type of individual sanctity I'm talking about, the type of pluralistic and diverse ideas I'm talking about, have nothing to do with the much, much later evolution of individualism that is the product of enlightenment, secularism, liberalism, democracy, anthropocentrism, and all of those things that happened in Europe and moved to the Western world. It's a completely different evolution. It's a Jewish track that comes and says, look, albeit we have one God, there is a difference between what God says and what we hear. And what we are here to do is to debate over what we hear and to allow each person to come into the table and share what they heard so we can formulate a communal way of life. Guys, first of all, you know, that's another thing. Identity by definition, in my opinion, identity by definition is limitation. You cannot hold the rope on both ends. You cannot. So if I come and say that there is such a thing that I'm looking for that is called a Jewish identity, for the word Jewish to mean anything that is communal, by definition, it has to be boundary. And they have to be boundaries. Now, I come and say, let's talk about the boundaries. But to come and say everyone can be Jewish is like saying there isn't such a thing as Jewishness. It's a contradiction in terms. When you say everyone is something... Absolutely, I say there is. No, I say there is something that is Jewish, and there are some people who try to find that thing, and there are those who don't care about it or don't believe in it. No. Once I privately say the community, that's what the community wants and that's what the community needs, that's a problem. If the community now comes to a resolution of what it believes it wants to do, and that's its resolution as a Jewish community, by all means, I need to abide. I believe that I need to abide, even if it doesn't accommodate 100% my individual take. If they agree, who is to tell them otherwise? Who is to tell them otherwise? There will always be other sects who argue with you. But you see, the beauty of it is that if somebody comes to me and says, I say a dialogue is a profound element of Jewish life. If somebody tells me, I don't agree with you, let's talk about it, they contradict themselves. In other words, again, we have a long way to go, especially in the Western world, first of all, to make ourselves feel comfortable with the notion of boundaries on our identities, or that identifying ourselves in a certain way means that we include ourselves within a certain communal mind frame, and we do not necessarily identify with another mind frame. That doesn't mean that that other mind frame is bad. That's what I'm trying to get into people. It's, I say, look, I've known you for 4 weeks. I like you a lot. You're a great lady. If you think for a second that I like you like I like my wife or my mother, you're dead wrong. And I don't need to apologize to you. I have other relations with other people. That doesn't negate my relationship with you. But my relationship with you is on a certain level. And I have other people with whom my relationship is a much, much deeper level. Because I have many more points of contact with them. The same thing is with me and Jews.
Mm-hmm. I would say the vast majority of Jews kind of don't accept that.
Great. So you have a communal aspect here that doesn't accept another aspect. And so far we have a consensus about it. But you know what? I'll tell you another thing. There were a majority of Jews at a certain point in history that believed that their way of understanding Judaism is the right way. And eventually they became Christianity. And once they became Christianity, everything I just told you also applies to them. Identification works in two ways, via positiva and via negativa. Usually, when you're at the nascent stages of identity formation, via negativa works best. I'm not him. Who are you? I'm not sure yet, but I'm definitely not him. A lot of Jews do it fantastically well. I am anti-something. I definitely don't want anything to do with Reformed Jews. I want nothing to do with those humanistic Jews. I'm definitely not an Orthodox Jew. But who are you in the positive? Ooh, that becomes much, much, much more difficult. That's a process of identification that requires, first of all, understanding your uniqueness and understanding that your uniqueness is only half the way. Now you have to abide by a communal discourse. And unfortunately, the Western world is not used or doesn't want to discuss the issue of communal commitment. It's foreign to the modern world, this notion of communal commitment. To the Jewish world, it's not as foreign because we come from such a background, but it becomes less and less easy or more and more challenging to discuss in a communal fashion. About meaningful questions, I'm not talking about paying your dues to the shul or how big the JCC should be, all of which are very important questions. But I'm talking about existential questions. Individuals will find it very difficult to let the community create the platform for meaning making. It's a challenge for us. But I believe we have to call the baby by its name. I mean, communal sanctity means a communal dialogue.
So that's the definition?
It's my definition, and you're welcome to dialogue with me and suggest your own, and I'll be more than happy to hear, and if needs be, I'll change my view. What I gave you is my definition, not a communal definition. It's a definition that I would like to bring into the table and have other Jews dialogue with me over it. But what I cannot accept is a dialogue that has no commitment on its part. In other words, I come, I say, and I go and continue. If you and I want to have a meaningful dialogue, you have to commit to me, I have to commit to you. As a Jew. That's communal sanctity.
I think that's part of where the struggle comes into having plural acceptance, because some groups of Jews will say, I have committed myself so deeply to learning and understanding everything I can possibly can about this, and then I will come to a dialogue with you about it if you make that commitment too. But they find that I'm not gonna have a dialogue, I'm not gonna spend my time with someone that's decided this morning to read one sentence and come argue with me, and they haven't committed themselves, but show me your commitment and I'll sit down and talk to you.
Right.
But that's not what happens, and that's why there's so much disconnect.
You'll be amazed how many Jews would love to have you as a dialogue partner. And this is one of the things I tell people all over the world. When I hear what you said many, many times in different constellations, say, oh, there's so many people who do not even see me as a Jew. They will never sit with dialogue with me. They hate me. Those Orthodox guys. Hey, guys, there are enough Jews.
I'm not even saying that. I'm saying that person saying that, they are making a commitment. They are saying, I actually want to sit with you. I want to sit with you more than once. I want to sit and talk and really, I want to think about this. Some Jews will say they don't want to talk to a person because they aren't saying that to them. They aren't coming to them and saying, I really want to have a real dialogue. There's some people that are just coming and they really spent, like, they woke up one morning and decided to sit, like, have a point of view about something and shout it out to someone, and that isn't a dialogue. So I'm saying that's why some people will say, I don't want to have a dialogue.
Find those. Find the circles with whom you can come into a dialogue, because those you cannot come into a dialogue will not change for you. They will not change for you. Something else may change them. But there is enough work in the Jewish world for each and every one of us to create dialogues until the end of our lives. Let's
focus.
Exactly. Be a Duke. Let's do it. And by the way, that's exactly what we're doing right now, unless you're not feeling what is happening here. But that's precisely the process. To put things on the table and have the guts to first of all, to continue and and make meaningful decisions about your life. And by the way, I hope you listen to me very carefully. I never said anything about religion. A lot of people say, when you say making serious decisions about our life, it's probably I need to become more for myself. I never talked about religious life. I never talked about what you perceive as religion. I just talked about making, and you'll be surprised at how many profound decisions you can make without, we are informed by so much preconceived assumptions about Judaism that we are scared to take the first step. And there is much more leeway than we believe. And once we enter, we see it's much richer, it's much more complex, and it wants to hear your voice. That's the most important lesson I want to give you today. It yearns for your voice. It doesn't want to shut you up, it wants to hear you. Unfortunately, there are so many Jews who really think that there is no interested Judaism on the other side, that tradition has been shaped by those big rabbis. Moshe Woldox from Boston calls them the big rabbi who says no. That's how they perceive them. Don't say no. So many of us shut their eyes to see that the Jewish texts call us to come in. We, along the line, because of our own ignorance. So many secular Jews in Israel say, oh, the religious people, they have monopoly over religion. And look, they say, what the hell are you talking about? Is there anybody in this country who doesn't allow you to open a Torah, a Midrash? There are Batei Midrashot more than there are coffee shops in Tel Aviv. What are you talking about? Admit it for yourself. You're an ignorant fool, and you want to remain an ignorant fool, and you're lazy. Why are you blaming the Orthodox guy in Jerusalem? Has he stopped you? Is there anybody in this country who will stop you from opening a book and read? What the hell are you talking about? Look yourself in the mirror, say I'm a fat, lazy bastard, and then we'll start talking. Then I'll open and invite you, and let's start learning. Let's see if somebody stops you, if somebody has a monopoly over Judaism. Excuses over excuses over excuses. You know what? We're not even original with those excuses. They've been there for hundreds of years. They've been there. What? What do you mean, can't? No, you don't, guys. I don't care about how you define yourselves. I'm talking about how we live here. You can come and say, Zohar, according everything you said is beautiful. You know, and according to halacha, you are born to a Jewish mother. End of story. What, you're going to tell me I'm not Jewish? I'm not telling people if they're Jewish or not. I don't care about this stuff. What I'm saying is there is a difference between being alive as a Jew, by definition, and living Jewishly. It's just like there's a difference between breathing and living. Everybody who breathes doesn't necessarily live. I'm talking about the meaning of Jewish life. I'm not talking about being, oh, you think I care about the definition? I don't care about the definition. Call yourself whatever you want. But I'm trying to show you that the idea of meaning-making in Jewish life is the symbiosis between this notion of accepting who you are and accepting the awesome responsibility that comes with that understanding, and then affording that awesome responsibility and status to other Jews. To become an active voice that determines what is the trajectory of Judaism in the present and the future.
So to get involved.
Not just to get involved, to change your life. What do you mean to get involved? What? To contribute for Hanukkah? What is get involved? I'm talking about becoming a Jew in a way that you feel comfortable with, but not comfortable because you're lazy. A comfort that comes from knowledge. I'm not talking about religion. If you want religion, the religious aspect, the ritual aspect, by all means. I will be the last one who stops you. I'm talking about changing your life in a way that makes you a fuller member of the Jewish community, a fuller contributor.
Judaism, not in terms of religion.
I'm a guy, if you heard anything from what I talked about, all the...
No,
religion is an element of the Jewish way of life. It's not. It's Judaism is not a religion. Judaism has a religious component in it.
So you're actually advocating learning. You're advocating engaging, creating your voice. And how do you get your voice? You have to enter into some kind of a dialogue. How do you enter into a dialogue?
To sharpen.
You acquaint yourself. Yeah. You acquaint yourself with this stuff, for that matter.
I'll tell you the way I like to...
How you're defining Judaism. You're defining for you the person that is willing.
Let me show you. Look, my dear, we're at the year 2010. We're reading texts that were written 1700 years ago. In the past, right? And the reason we are in dialogue with that past, or at least in an enriched monologue in our own mind, because they're not giving us an answer, but they definitely helped us open a fantastic question, is because this past, 1700 years ago, these people, yeah, they contributed something to the evolution of Judaism. Now let me tell you, one day in the future, all of us, you included, are going to become Judaism's past. Whether you like it or not. One day in the future, we're going to become Judaism's past. And the question of what kind of a past you want to be in the future is a question for the present. It's recorded right here. Okay? The question of what kind of a past you want to be in the future is a question of the present.
An absent past or an
active. Exactly! Do you want to become a voice in that past, or do you want to submerge into obscurity because of your lack of commitment? The choice is completely yours. Do you want to put a thumbprint? What do people do today? They get Jewish tradition. They study in Sunday school, Hebrew school. They take it, the tradition, immediately pass it to our children. Every Shabbat, you hear the same sermon by the same rabbi. We have to pass the tradition to our children. It is our children say that in the future, the Jewish continuity. What the hell do you want to continue? What is it you want to continue that is so important to you? What? Take tradition, which was passed to you by the past. Take a breath. Play with it a little. Engage in the traditioning process. Become part of that tradition and pass it to the future with your own imprint. You are part of that. Why do you just pass? Play. It's your life. Why do you talk about our children all the time? Let's talk about us. We became a bunch of ignoramus. We don't know anything. And then we teach our children, and they're not stupid. They see this dry tree. Why am I to be interested in this? Even that, I'm not even talking about that. I'm just giving us now the very, very broad strokes. Let's not get into the higher resolution here. But the problem is, we forgot somewhere along the line that Judaism, the tradition, is an evolving process of which we are part. And we have to put our thumb, our print, into that tradition. That's what I said. One day in the future, you'll be someone's past. Do you want to be present in that past or not? Do you want to be submerged in someone else's work from 1700 years ago? You know what I suggest to headmasters of schools? Say you have a school, a Jewish school. I hope to God you don't call it religious school. The Jewish school, right? You teach Judaism then, not only religion. And you have a book, you have a library. Are there any books written by your own students in that library? Next to Ashi, next to Maimonides? You had a class of Bible studies all year. They answered to profound questions. Did you ask them to write them down, put them in a book and wrote it, the wisdom of our students, instead of just the ethics of our fathers? Would you think about next year, when you have another class of seventh graders, now one of their homeworks will be to go to the library and teach and read the wisdom of our students alongside the ethics of our fathers and do homework about what Kathy said right alongside Rashi. What's the problem? Why do we avert to go to the past for wisdom rather than to look for it right here and to allow our students from the day they can think understand that they are part of a dialogue, that what they say counts. It matters. We raised generations upon generations of people who receive Judaism rather than participate in it. Eventually you let go. It's not interesting. You don't want me to tell you what I think.
When it's no longer a religion, it's a what?
It's not that it's no longer a religion. It's not only a religion. The religious world is part of the Jewish expression. But to think that Judaism is only a religious expression is a profoundly myopic lens.
So positivity is...
In my opinion, It is a way of meaning making in life. It is a way of living. It is a way of perceiving ethics, relationship with others. Don't get me wrong, religion aims to give answers to all these questions within a communal mind frame. But if you do not abide by every ritual element, that does not mean that you cannot come into dialogue about the same concepts. That's what I wanted to understand.
One of the cross-cutting problems of all this is that different people have different tolerances for ambiguity.
Yeah.
For a lot of people, the point of all of this is to get to
Tachlis.
The answer.
Tachlis.
And that assumes that there is the answer.
Yes.
Whereas everything that you're showing us tonight shows us that sometimes
patience.
Jews just have to live on the question. And that is the source of the meaning that they create in their lives.
Very difficult.
A lot of people can't handle that because it's very threatening.
Yeah.
Well, that's acceptable, but that's part of the pluralism. Now you have to accept that amongst ourselves there will be a group of people that are only interested in telling what I have to do. Just don't
bother.
And that's got the legitimate place within the plethora of.
But you're right. You're right. Ambiguity is a very threatening or uncomfortable thing to the human.
For others, it's
To others, ambiguity allows you to, you know, to really explore in different directions rather than just run to the target. You know, Ishli Odaka? I'll end up with a beautiful story that I like. Apropos of ambiguity. There's a story. Maybe some of you know. I read it on an email. It talks about a man who stands on a cliff, and he's about. He looks down and he's very scared of what he sees. And God stands next to this person and says to him, "Jump." And the person looks at him and says, "It's very deep. I mean, I'm going to die." God said, "Trust me, jump." He says, no, if I die, I'll crash and it will be the end of me. He says, "I'm God, trust me, make this leap of faith, jump." He says, "Okay, coming close," and then he regrets it. So God pushes him. God pushes him off the cliff. And then the man talks and says, I screamed. I yelled. And then I started looking around. I realized that I'm not going to crash. And for the first time in my life, I started to fly. So ambiguity can become a fantastic thing as well if you take it in the right
context. Can I tell you another story?
Yeah, go ahead.
This is in Eastern Europe, I don't know, 200 or 150 years ago, and there's a young Jew who loses his faith, and he goes and he searches for the answer, the secret of existence, and he searches the Far Eastern religions and other traditions and so on. Nowhere can he find it until somebody tells him there's a tzaddik in some distant corner of Eastern Europe who is so holy that he's the only one who knows the secret of life. I'll make it short. He goes through tremendous difficulty to get there, crosses the border illegally, suffers, and so finally reaches it. He gets there, the man makes him wait 6 months before he leaves and giving him an audience. Finally, he gets to him and he says, "Rebbe, I'm not a believing Jew, but I beg you to tell me what is the secret of life. You're the only one who knows." He looks up and he says, "I don't know, I guess it's, you know, willingness to dialogue with people and to be halfway and to really listen to one another and so on." And the guy gets furious. He says, "What? For these cliches?
For these
truisms? I went through all of this?" And the rabbi gets concerned about him. He says, "Listen, don't upset yourself so much." He says, "Maybe it's not the willingness."
Right. Right. Okay, so I was wrong. Right. Okay, so it's not. Okay. Okay, chavarim, thank you.
See you this Wednesday.
We're meeting this Wednesday.